This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it's Friday when we dive beneath the headlines on one of the biggest stories of the week, and this week, the uptick in violence in Boston. On Tuesday, Boston Mayor Michelle Wu met with faith and community leaders to address recent events.
There is a lot of conversation around trauma response and the need to ensure that we are touching every single person, every student who might be at all impacted by recent events.
On Wednesday,
we are learning that this was not a random attack, but as you can see behind me, this happened on a busy, well-lighted street, and it happened just after 7 p.m. while Celebrity Cuts Barbershop was still open.
A man killed at a barbershop in Dorchester. This after a string of violence that killed and injured others, including teenagers, and including a stabbing inside a local high school. Now, these recent events have citizens worried.
There's chaos on the streets. And people do not feel safe, and the belief is that things are out of control in terms of violence in Dorchester and Roxbury and Mattapan.
All sounds thanks to WCVB Boston. You heard Mayor Michelle Wu there, WCVB's Mary Saladna, and Reverend Kevin Peterson. Reverend Peterson is the founder of the New Democracy Coalition, which focuses on civic empowerment with a focus on Boston's Black community. And he's also an associate faculty member of the Center for Anti-Racist Research at Boston University. Reverend Peterson joins us here in Studio 2. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Also here, native of Roxbury and graduate of the John D. O'Brien School of Mathematics and Science in Roxbury, Representative Liz Miranda, who represents the state's 5th congressional district, which includes both Roxbury and Dorchester. Welcome back, Representative.
Good morning.
So I'll start with you, Representative. What's been on your mind these last few weeks?
I mean, when you see a 14-year-old and a 16-year-old killed, two young mothers at 24 and 32 who are leaving children behind, a 91-year-old community leader getting stabbed and assaulted in a public park, and just yesterday a 7-year-old was found with a loaded gun in a backpack outside of the schools in the district. You sense the fear, you sense the sadness, and you realize as a community leader that you've got to do something immediate to respond to the violence. I know that gun deaths and shootings have been down, and we have the lowest number of gun deaths in the Commonwealth, and we have very strict gun laws. But when you live in a community like Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan, that doesn't matter when you lose your children, when you lose your siblings. And so I've been really committed to this my entire life. I also am a survivor. And so I have been incredibly triggered by the recent events that have been happening, and was at my urging that we met with the faith leaders and elected officials with the mayor so that we could respond to the community with a plan.
So, Reverend Peterson, I will come to you in a minute, but Representative Miranda, I want to both be respectful and follow up about you being a survivor. You've been public about that. You lost your brother, Michael, in 2017. It's part of what made you want to run for office. How are you thinking about what he would want now?
You know, I was an out-of-school time worker for many years, a community organizer. Actually, one of my first jobs was with Reverend Peterson here, registering people to vote, understanding growing up in the Dudley Triangle how voteless people can be a hopeless people. And I would think that Michael would want me to do what I'm just doing now. We have to respond as an entire community. What was really exciting about the meeting at the urging of folks in community to do that meeting is that we understand that we have to have a unified approach. It's not just an elected problem. It's not just a faith leader problem. We have to bring everyone, frontline workers, survivor families, young people, the hospitals together. And so I believe that what I have in terms of ideas around improving the out-of-school time framework so there's more opportunity for young people in the city, creating hubs around places that have actually had crime. When an incident of violence happens in a community, folks don't need trauma services just on that day. They need it for a long period of time. And so it's important for us to come back in 3 days and 5 days and 2 weeks to figure out what families and young people need. And I think, you know, Michael's children have been the best source of inspiration for me. His sons were 3 and 7 at the time. It's been 5 years. And what they remind me of is that young people are not just the future, they're the present. And if we want to build a city that is safe and healthy, we have to include them at the table on how to make things safer. There's just too many guns in our communities and high-capacity weapons. A 7-year-old, a second grader showing up to a school with a loaded gun is deeply, deeply problematic for our city, and everyone should care.
So, Reverend Kevin Peterson, I'm just going to invite you to pick it up from there.
Well, I agree with everything that the senator-elect has articulated. I think if there was something that I would highlight, it would be that on the higher levels, it's very important for us to think about reimagining how to approach this issue again. We've had success in the city of Boston in terms of addressing the issues of crime and public safety. The 10-point model worked two decades ago. We have a different Boston now, a different black community. Post-COVID, other kinds of stresses and other kind of idiosyncrasies have occurred within the community that has allowed this community or put this community into a place where the impact of the violence over the last couple of weeks has hit hard and in a different way. I've taken the pains to go out to the crime scenes of these murders over the last 3 weeks just to get a sense of how the community is responding. And it's not well. There is a deep sense of anxiety and pain and fear and frustration. And if we are to be honest, we must say that there is a great deal of distrust between the community and between the police and City Hall. I've heard it. Those who are victims. Those breaches need to be mended. Those gaps need to be brought together. So I would suggest that we take a step back and talk about how we build the relationships again, how we reimagine a way of collaboratively coming together to create a plan. I would say first, the black community must reassess its ability to police itself without the police. It must depend upon the resources that it has as institutions, its individual capacities, block watch associations, our churches. It must privately, in some ways, have conversations to talk about how it reduces crime. It must think more deeply about practices of nonviolence that can be talked about in the homes, in the churches, and on the streets. It must think through the importance of telling the police what they witness in terms of crimes in the community. So there must be internal, intensely private conversations within the black community to address the crime. And then at a certain point, there needs to be a reengagement with the police so that those issues that have been talked about within the black community can be expressed and articulated to them so that we come to a comprehensive, collaborative public safety violence reduction strategy. The beauty of the black community has always been that it has afforded itself the ability to solve its own problems independent of government. I think that this type of strategy is very, very important. We are disappointed. I am disappointed. I'll speak for myself. That the that municipal government has not articulated a clear public safety plan. Even coming out of the meeting at Greater Love Baptist Church, some asked for what first steps are being taken, and the leadership out of that meeting were wanting in terms of articulating what they would do.
So I'm going to stop you there. We're hearing Reverend Kevin Peterson, sure, who's the founder of the New Democracy Coalition, and Representative Liz Miranda, the Democrat of 5th Suffolk, including Roxbury and Dorchester. You referred to her as the senator-elect because you're running unopposed for
yes,
the state Senate.
So
I stopped you there, Reverend, just because sure, there are so many pieces there sure, that I want to pick up in sure, our limited time. So let's begin with the need and the desire to act privately for a community itself to address its needs. And I, Representative Miranda, it is such a resource-rich set of communities in Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan, with organizations I'm thinking of, Mothers for Justice and Equality. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of Freedom House, the St. Peter's Teen Center. I mean, we can just organization after organization. Is there a coordination and a plan among all the community organizations deeply engaged? Reverend Peterson was just saying, expressing dissatisfaction that there isn't one at the city level. But is there one among the community organizations?
So yes and no. I think inherently when you grow up in this community, you know, Michael wasn't my first loss. You know, I lost my neighbor at age 18, also named Michael, Michael Tavares, when I was a freshman at Wellesley. And so I've spent the better part of my adulthood losing people each year, whether they were friends or siblings of folks. And there's a deep sense that we have generational trauma, the lack of access to really good, culturally competent, affordable, accessible mental health care that, you know, a lot of people in my community are, they have the ideas, but the coordination of these ideas, I think, when he talks about Reverend Peterson about the distrust, there is a huge distrust between policing in our communities because policing hasn't always seen, has been seen as a way to get to a safer community. You know, in the Fitzsuffolk district, we are one of the most policed incarcerated corridors in the entire state, yet we're still not safe. We're fourth in terms of violent crime, only behind the cities of Boston, Springfield, and Brockton collectively. So there is a desire, I know, for a lot of youth organizations, mm-hmm. a lot of community organizations like the NAACP, the ULEM, and we could go on and on. But there hasn't been sort of a collective, I believe, healing or coming together of all levels of government and leadership. But there is a commitment. And one of the things that I saw, you do not solve 40 years of a trajectory in urban communities of crime and violence and disinvestment, and arguably 400 years mm-hmm. Of that investment for Black people, disinvestment for Black people in one meeting. And so I have urged my colleagues to meet weekly until we come up with a plan that can be public shaping, that we co-create this plan with community, and that we open up our doors and our offices to really learn from the people on the front lines. There are currently hospitals, 100% of penetrating, victims of penetrating wounds go into hospitals. So they have a role to play. The doctors, the violence coordinators, the trauma workers, our SOAR members, these folks who are addressing violence on the ground level. And so there's a desire. I would say that this opportunity post-COVID of community care is what I'd like to see our communities get back to. Even though I lived in a community that was facing a lot of gang violence when I was growing up in Roxbury on Dudley Street in the 80s and 90s, the one thing that I knew is I could go to my youth center and there was a caring adult that told me that I mattered and I was loved and I was safe. And I don't think teenagers today or young adults feel that that framework is there for them. Many places they're not welcomed and not supported. And there's not the same number of youth organizations mm-hmm. that there were, or youth jobs, or young adult jobs that there were in the 80s and 90s that we need to get back to.
So Reverend Peterson, Mayor Wu was here on Monday and talked about, for example, the building of the new community center right mm-hmm. across from the Jeremiah Burke High School, which will be a standalone community center. That'll change the hours that it's available, who can come in and out, et cetera, because it won't be connected to the high school. You just expressed frustration a minute ago that the city is not taking a lead on creating, my words, not yours, a comprehensive sort of codified plan of response. What are the key building blocks? We've got 2 minutes. What are the key building blocks?
Well, I don't think they should be taking a lead. I think they should be collaborating with the community. I think the key building block is a willfulness to create a plan that is comprehensive, that looks at all strata across the Black community in terms of providing safety. And by that, I mean youth. By that, I mean adults. By that, I mean collaborating with community institutions, including clergy and our community centers, our nonprofit organizations that focus on young people. The city needs to have an eye on that. On the city side, there should be a real close look at what community policing means. I know you only have a few minutes, but we have so many police officers currently. Here's a quick solution to a problem. So many police officers currently in special units, bicycle units, and motorcycles, and the gang unit, who can be walking the street today? If we had a police unit walking the street down the Washington Street corridor where a young man was murdered this week, perhaps that would not have happened by having a presence there on that corridor, which is considered one of the most dangerous in the city of Boston. So community policing can be actualized in a real way in the Black community tomorrow.
Celebrity Cuts, the barbershop, is on Washington Street. Mm-hmm. Actually, I think we're going to... I'm going to end it there. You hear me pause because, of course, we've just touched, right? We've just touched the surface. This is a conversation we need to continue to have and hopefully continue to have here. So I will thank you for starting it with us. Representative Liz Miranda, the state's 5th Congressional District, running unopposed for state Senate, grew up in Boston's Roxbury neighborhood. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Kevin Peterson, founder, Reverend Kevin Peterson, founder of the New Democracy Coalition and associate faculty member for the Center for Anti-Racist Research at BU. Thank you to you as well.
Thank you.
Whoa, 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 whoa. Come on. This is a great... It's hallowed ground. Witches can't set foot here. He talks.
A bit of hocus pocus there to set the mood, because why not? That is Max Dennison and Talking Cat Thackeray Binks, of course. Now, whether it's fear, it's intrigue, it's sadness, awe, terror, or something else entirely, graveyards, cemeteries have a way of sparking visceral emotion for many of us. And our next guest is a bit of an expert in the area. Journalist and author Greg Melville's new book is called Over My Dead Body, Unearthing the Hidden History of America's Cemeteries. He joins us now in Studio 2. Greg, welcome.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. And listen, you hooked me literally from the first line of this book, right? You start in the prologue with this line: "The first time I put a body in the ground was on a clear June morning before my senior year of college, and I immediately was with you." So I'm actually going to start by having you read a little bit more from the prologue for our listeners. And this is about the first grave you and your co-worker Billy dug when you were working at the Shawsheen Cemetery in Bedford, Massachusetts.
Sure. After the backhoe finished scooping out the Shawsheen Cemetery soil and depositing it onto a piece of plywood, Billy and I exited the truck, reached for our shovels, and dropped into the newly dug hole. Machines do much of the heavy work these days, except in hard-to-reach nooks where only a shovel can reach. The smell of fresh earth enveloped us as we shaved the grave shaft's sides and leveled the floor to the proper size, about 8 feet long, 3 feet wide, and 5 feet in depth. As I stood in the fresh grave, I couldn't help but feel a little claustrophobic, or maybe I was just freaking out a little about the prospect of someday being deposited in a hole like this one for eternity, or at least a long time.
So you were young. Did you know then, was that the start of your sort of love affair and interest in cemeteries, or back then was it just a job?
At the start, it was just a job. And my love affair, as you put it, I'd like to say is a healthy love affair.
Yeah. Listen, I love cemeteries, so let me be very clear about that right now. Go ahead.
But yes, it really opened my eyes quite a bit, because I had always kind of thought of cemeteries in the way that you think of them in horror movies. And then spending all that time there mowing the lawns and really investigating the stories of the graves and the story of the graveyard itself, which told the story of the town, really came alive to me and opened my eyes to just what amazing places, what amazing capsules of history cemeteries can be.
So I'll confess there was another reason that your prologue particularly caught me. So we lived in Bedford for about 10 years.
Okay.
We lived in the Nathan Fitch House. So that
Ooh,
there are a number.
Right.
Yeah. So there, and there are a number of Fitch. And when we first moved there, not long after our first child was born, you know, we strapped her into the backpack. We went up to the Shawsheen Cemetery to look for the Fitches and stood among a number of graves. Mm-hmm. And were too I love cemeteries, too uncomfortable to stay. Being that present with the families that had been in your home, it was overwhelming. It brings you that history in such a personal way.
Right. And it's funny you mentioned that, because about the Fitches, because I remember them catching my eye too. The names of the families of the town really come alive to you in a cemetery. And it's amazing to look at the generations of people, especially in to me, because there were so many names that were familiar to me, not only through history, but then also through people that I knew in the town.
Interesting.
And to see that come alive, and to see how history has changed the fortunes of the town, the art of the town, everything. But every cemetery has a story like that.
So I want to talk about some of the cemeteries, but I'm going to stay in the personal space for just a minute longer. This is part two of a series this week we've called Radio Boston's Going to the Grave. And in the first, we spoke with a woman named Rachel Meyer, co-founder of Epoch Preservation, who does historical grave preservation, cleaning up, restoration. She lost her mother during the pandemic. She was not able to have a traditional burial. And one of the things that sort of held her together was doing the headstone. Mm-hmm. And here is what she said when I asked her what she put on her mother's headstone.
I grew up in a public housing project and we had so very little, but she sacrificed so much. And I wanted to make sure that everybody knew that she was a scholar and she was so proud of being a scholar. And so I put mother and scholar on it. And I wanted everyone to know how very loved she was, because we didn't have these funerals. And how would anyone know unless I put it right on the gravestone? So I made sure I put loved on the corner and that she was a mother and a scholar.
Part of the reason I love talking to you after talking to Rachel is she focuses on that individual grave. And you have been to cemeteries all over the country and write a lot about their role in a community.
Right.
Do you also have that, you know, are you struck by these personal messages on gravestones? And have you seen different things, different places?
Oh, absolutely. There are about 144,000 burial grounds, cemeteries, graveyards across the country of varying sizes, obviously, and varying stories established at different times. And they all really do have their own unique story that is told from the architecture and art that's in them, but then also through the love of the people who have memorialized their loved ones in them as well.
So we're speaking with Greg Melville, who is a journalist and author of Over My Dead Body, Unearthing the Hidden History of America's Cemeteries. I want to dive into a few of the cemeteries that are from our region.
Yeah.
And let's go to Plymouth.
Okay.
I was really struck that you made a very conscious choice in writing about the cemetery in Plymouth to address head on the erasure of Native graves and the piece of that history, even while looking at the robust history of how that cemetery emerged. So tell us a little bit.
Right. So when the pilgrims first came, they stopped on Cape Cod first before they went over to Plymouth. And at that time, they were trying to look on Cape Cod if there was somewhere that they could settle for good. And they really couldn't find anywhere that gave them a regular source of water and everything, and it was really sheltered. But they did some expeditions to try and find treasure or other stores. And the first thing that they came upon was, or one of the first things they came upon were some graves. And they dug up the graves and found stores of grain and corn that were buried with some of the local indigenous people and they were buried there for basically so that these people could carry these stores with them in the afterlife. And it was this initial act of grave robbing that actually sustained the pilgrims through their first winter. And it kind of it kind of started this ongoing and never-ending tradition of desecrating indigenous people's graves that has continued to this day.
All right, so I want to pick up on two things there. We're talking about Burial Hill in Plymouth.
Yes.
What's interesting about that in part is that you're presenting these parallel tracks of history, the one we've told for a long time. These are where some of the Mayflower passengers are buried.
Right.
Along with the history that we are grappling with now that we did erase around our relationship with the Native American populations there, the Mashpee Wampanoag, et cetera. So I'm going to play a little bit of sound from our Indigenous Peoples Day show. We talked with Hartman Dietz, who's a Mashpee Wampanoag historian and activist, who talked about the fact that beyond the atrocities that were committed against the indigenous people here in the past, part of it's still ongoing.
It's an ongoing struggle in the face of genocide that's happened in very real and bloody ways, but also on paper, eliminating people by lack of recognition, by lack of acknowledgement of their identity, of who they are.
How can cemeteries, which are a thing of the past, the people who are gone, still help us stop that?
I think that cemeteries are kind of this unfiltered lens through which we can see ourselves and our country and our history, and it's why it's so important to protect them. In 1990, we passed the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, which has played a small role, but not enough of a role in protecting indigenous peoples' burial grounds and sacred sites. So many of them have been, like you said, erased and are continuing to be under threat. It was why we created, or the Obama administration originally created, the Bears Ears National Monument, or part of the reason, because of these sacred grounds. But we can really see in how we treat the dead, we can really see this true, clear reflection of ourselves.
So let's now go back to this idea of how a cemetery reflects in a community. And I want to go to Mount Auburn Cemetery, where I feel over the years we've learned a lot about the nature that's there, the birds that are there, the community resource that it is. But there was still a piece I was really struck by in your chapter about it being kind of this first rural cemetery, was a phrase that you used, and a different imagination of a role a cemetery could play in a community.
Sure. So to that time, cemeteries in Boston and New York and London and Paris, they were filling up with bodies. Basically, until that time, until the early 19th century, cemeteries or burial grounds came in basically two kinds. They were either attached to a house of worship, or they were a separate plot, family plot in a farm or something like that. But because of the overcrowding, there were the concerns of pollution of water, the smell. People were afraid of the miasma somehow spreading disease. And then there was also the problem of grave robbing. There were not just for people hunting for treasures, but take in Boston, for instance, there was, because Harvard Medical School was so new, medical students were digging up graves and stealing the cadavers for research.
Because there was no process for that at the time.
Exactly. And so there was the state legislature actually made it a felony to dig up graves because of the Harvard students. But so then this notion of creating an untethered separate garden of graves came up, and it was really inspired by something similar in Paris. And this garden of graves, Mount Auburn Cemetery, was really the birthplace of landscape architecture. It was really kind of the first park in America. It was the second most popular tourist attraction after it was created, behind Niagara Falls.
The first real park in America was a cemetery.
That's right. If you take Boston Common, for instance, it existed at that time, but it was largely a military encampment. There were livestock on it. It was used for hangings and things like that, but it wasn't used as a place where people would recreate or come and have a picnic and just get away from the bustle of the city.
So we've got a couple minutes left. I'd love to hit Sleepy Hollow Cemetery in Concord, Massachusetts for a minute. And but many people who do know it for Authors Hill, for the Transcendentalists who were
right.
buried there. But this idea that it was a way to provide ecological preservation as well is quite interesting. So give us just a minute on that.
Sure. Basically, at that time, Concord was 90% clear-cut for farms, and Ralph Waldo Emerson wanted to create a natural preserve. At that time, nature was seen as something to be conquered in America, not preserved, and so he wanted to create this cemetery in a very transcendentalist way, where bodies would go back to the earth and join with nature, and he saw it as this perfect nature preserve to turn it into a cemetery so it will forever be wild, I guess.
So the cemetery that has spoken most to you in all the years you've traveled and done this?
Truly, it's a Potter's Field in Wilmington, Delaware, believe it or not, that I've run by a couple of times that is only accessible by a bike path. Hmm. And each grave is only marked with a number. And there's something very profound about it. What it says about our society, these unmarked graves. And I try and give, when I stop there, I try just for a moment to contemplate and try and give these people agency that maybe they didn't have in life.
Wow. Greg Melville, new book is Over My Dead Body, Unearthing the Hidden History of America's Cemeteries. Greg will be at the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge tonight at 7 p.m. to talk more about the book. And you can find more information on that, as well as on the book itself, at our website, radioboston.org. Greg, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was my pleasure.
So that was part two of going to the grave this week. And with Halloween festivities looming this weekend, we want to lurk now in some of the region's spookier places to visit, or maybe think about safely from afar. With us to do that, Jeff Bellinger, author of Weird Massachusetts and co-host of the podcast New England Legends. Jeff, welcome back.
Good to be with you, Tiziana.
It's great to have you. I know you're out on a speaking tour. I appreciate you taking the time. And I know you're going to take us to some regional haunts. and so we're going to feature that. You featured them all on your podcast, and we'll introduce each one with some podcast sound. So first up.
So what are we looking for while we're here in town, Jeff?
The spirit of Christmas.
That's exactly what we're looking for. We're going to head into the lobby of the Parker House Hotel right here in the heart of downtown in search of the ghost of the man who brought Christmas to Boston.
So we have spoken to the historian at the Omni Parker House about this. Who is the man that brought Christmas, the ghost and the man who brought Christmas back to Boston?
I love this story because really, if you think about it, everything we know about what Christmas is supposed to mean is based on a ghost story crafted by a master named Charles Dickens. Charles Dickens, who came to the Parker House Hotel, rehearsed over and over in front of a mirror, reading that story back in 1867 when he brought that story to Boston and then really to America. And that mirror now hangs on the mezzanine level of the hotel right next to the elevator. And there's a little plaque that says this is the mirror where, you know, Charles Dickens did this reading. And they say once in a while you can catch a glimpse of Charles Dickens in that mirror.
And so just quickly for listeners, Christmas had been outlawed basically at one point.
Yeah.
It wasn't well celebrated. And you credit him with creating a love for Christmas in America that eventually led to it becoming a national holiday.
In 1659, the Puritans of Boston banned Christmas. There was a 5-shilling fine if you were caught making merry or dancing or celebrating or other, quote, satanical practices. That ban was lifted a couple decades later, but it wasn't a thing. I mean, 1700s, 1800s, that puritanical war on Christmas continued until Charles Dickens really almost secularized it and said, this is what it's supposed to mean. It's a time for charity. It's a time for redemption. And if we're haunted by our past, then, you know, we can change overnight. And of course, we realize by the end of the story who Ebenezer Scrooge really is. He's us.
That's right. So listen, I have actually rehearsed the opening to A Christmas Carol in front of that mirror at the Omni Parker House. And for listeners, we're bringing it back there, the live reading of A Christmas Carol, December 20th. So you'll be able to catch that. Okay.
Oh,
so,
I love that. Wait. Yeah. Don't bury the lead. Did you see the ghost?
I did not. Oh, and I really, really wanted to.
Fair enough.
Okay. We're going to go to the North Shore now. Here we go.
Okay.
Our destination is actually this tiny stretch of beach right next to the Barnacle Restaurant.
Wow, that's not very big.
No.
Maybe 4 car lengths wide and maybe 20 feet of rocky beach between the wall and the water, depending on the tide, I suppose.
Yeah, this is the place where they say you can still hear a ghost they call the Screeching Lady of Marblehead.
And of course, you're speaking with your co-host, Ray Auger, there. Take us back to the 1600s to Marblehead and tell us about her.
So this was a time of pirates, and the story goes that there was a pirate ship that had captured another ship and taken an older woman prisoner, and she had a big green emerald on her ring finger, and they couldn't get the ring off. But the captain insisted that the woman be treated well, and she sailed with them all the way to Marblehead, and when the pirates all went on shore to pillage and plunder, the people in the village saw them coming and hid. And the woman saw this as an opportunity to escape, so she jumped off the pirate ship, swam for shore, and by the time she reaches shore, the pirates, frustrated that they found nothing they could plunder, find this woman, and they cut her finger off to get that ring, and then they murder her brutally as the locals listen from their hiding places and hear the screams and screeches of this woman. And the story continues to this day that you can still sort of hear that ghost. And I think what haunts the town is the idea that someone was in dire trouble and they did nothing way back when.
Are there prime conditions to hear that screeching over the water?
Well, I guess it depends how many drinks you've had at the Barnacle Restaurant right next door, where you can absolutely guaranteed find spirits behind the bar, I guess, right?
Fair enough.
So, Jack, Jose, they're all there.
All right, let's jump to the middle of the state now, and we're going to jump forward in time. 1970s, here we go.
Dover is a bit of an upscale commuter town located west of Boston.
It is. The houses are nice, the yards are well landscaped, and the quintessential New England colonial stone walls line the road.
Yep, picture perfect. But something tells me we're not walking Farm Street to admire the landscaping, Jeff.
No, we're not. We've come to Dover, Massachusetts, searching for a demon.
The Dover demon. Dun-dun-dun. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so April 21st, 1977, a high schooler named Bill Bartlett was out cruising, looking for something fun to do on their spring break. On Farm Street, about 10 o'clock at night, he sees this creature that looks, it's got a sort of a big bulbous head. Its eyes glow when the headlights hit it, like an animal's eyes would. And it's got long, spindly fingers and spindly toes. And Bill Bartlett was completely freaked out. Also, it's important to note, he's a fine arts painter today, a really good one. And he went home and he drew what he saw. 2 hours later that night, another kid about a mile away has a sighting when he was leaving his girlfriend's house. And the following night, two teenagers parking in a car saw this thing flash by. So you only had four witnesses in the span of about 25 hours. And it was documented by Lauren Coleman in his book, Mysterious America. And Dover has come to sort of identify with this strange creature that was never seen again and called the Dover Demon simply because, you know, it was catchy. But what a strange cryptid that we still talk about today, even though there have been no other legitimate sightings.
And one of the things that struck me about that was the speculation that maybe it was an alien even.
Well, right. And then that would explain why you never see it again. And this is what happens with any legend. When you have credible people that say, look, I don't know what this is what I saw. I'm just describing what I saw. We try so hard to then put a label on it. And so, oh, it's probably an animal with mange. And Bill grew up there. He's like, I know what raccoons look like with mange. And I know.
This right? Not like, that.
Yeah. Like this. Yeah. I know what animals live around here and I know what don't. And so he drew it. That drawing is famous. You can find it just about anywhere.
All right. So we didn't get to the Black Flash from Provincetown and some others, but you can catch them. This was Jeff Bellinger, author of Weird Massachusetts and co-host of the podcast New England Legends with Ray Auger. You can catch more of them there. Jeff, thanks so much.
Thank you.
There are nearly 700,000 small businesses in Massachusetts. Roughly a fifth of them qualify as minority-owned. A new program called Pathways to Scale aims to help those businesses make it in the long term, and they do it by training owners to focus on leadership strategy alongside the day-to-day operations of running the company. This past summer, the program graduated their first cohort of 15 small businesses, and right now they're recruiting for a second round. In this edition of The Business of Boston, we take a look at the program and how shifting the mindset to include leadership helps business owners gain more stability in the long term. With us now, Daryl Byers, CEO of InterRise, who runs the program, and Vicky Gray, founder and owner of New Chapter HI Services, a property management and painting company in Cambridge. Daryl, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And Vicky, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Great to have you both. So, Daryl, I just want to start. Over this program, you help business leaders become leaders, because in a small business, it's so common to just be caught up in doing the work of the business day to day.
Correct. And what we teach businesses is how to work on their business and not in their business. And that happens a lot with business owners, and especially minority-owned businesses that really don't have the network. And we help bring businesses together, create a three-year growth strategy, and give them the tools through the five modules that happens over 7 months of our program, give them the tools that they need to grow their business.
So what are those five modules, just loosely?
Loosely, those five modules are marketing, HR, how to take care of yourself as well as your employees. Probably the most impactful I hear are, one, how to access capital, and two, how to really understand your finances.
So, Vicky, I'm going to turn to you now. My first question to you: what Daryl was saying about being caught up in the day-to-day running the business versus being able to step back, was that you before you went through this program?
Yes, absolutely. You know, when I first started my business, I didn't know how to run a business, you know, so I'm actually in the day-to-day operations, you know, making sure that things get done. And it didn't allow me to actually focus on my business and the needs for the actual business itself. You know, so when I went through the InterRise program, like Daryl said, it had provided me with the tools and the understandings into how to systematically run a successful business.
So tell us what New Chapter does, Vicky.
New Chapter HI Services specializes in interior and exterior painting services, and we also offer property maintenance services as well. We live by no dust, no mess, just straight, clean, honest, breathable work done with a smile. And we serve the federal government, local, state, and government, and commercial and residential clients as well.
So staying with you for one more question, Vicki, before I go back to Daryl, what is one thing that you do differently now as the owner of this business than you did before you took the course?
What I do now is I actually have the ability to, you know, look over the whole entire business and have a better understanding as to setting goals in each of those different areas that those seven different areas that Daryl had pointed out. You know, you have the ability to look at the overall business and see what the overall business needs. You have time to actually connect with individuals in order to make, you know, the goals achievable to happen, you know, versus when I was working in the business, I'm in people's houses cleaning up after the work has been done. There's only a certain amount of hours in a day. You know, there's only a certain amount of workable hours in a day. If I'm taking all of my time and I'm in the weeds cleaning individuals' homes, how is, you know, payroll going to get done?
Yeah.
You know, how is it going to, how are we going to be able to achieve those goals?
I'm assuming sell new business, for example.
Sell new business, exactly. Yeah.
We're speaking with Vicki Gray, who's the owner of New Chapter HI Services, and Daryl Byers, who's the CEO of Interrise. Interrise is offering a program called Pathways to Success that allows, that helps minority-owned businesses really strengthen through the long term by pathways to scale, by focusing on leadership. So, Daryl, how do you feel when you hear Vicki lay out what's changed for her?
As I always say about Vicki, she's our star alum, and she's done such a great job. But really taking what she learned in the Streetwise MBA, which is the name of the course we offered to Pathways to Scales, but taking that and growing with it and learning from it and continue to grow and continue to implement the 3-year growth strategy she learned. And really, you know, really during COVID, I know she took our other course, Interrise Strong, which really helped businesses survive the pandemic and build resiliency for when we came out of the pandemic. And she's taken that course and she's taken it to another level.
So, Daryl, I'm going to read a little data here from McKinsey & Company. Only 1% of Black-owned businesses or Black business owners get a bank loan in their first year of business, and that's compared with 7% of white owners. 30% of white owners use credit cards in their first year, compared with 15% of non-white owners. And overall, big banks approve just 29% of loan requests from Black-owned businesses, compared with 60% of white-owned businesses. So you talked about, in those five pillars, you talked about access to capital as a key one. How does the training, I mean, that's a structural challenge. Mm-hmm. How does the training help with that piece of the change?
Sure. I think the training, what it offers, first of all, it teaches you how to really understand your finances and what you need to get in order to qualify for a commercial loan, if you will. And what programs are out there for local, state, or federal government, most importantly. Because, you know, Black-owned businesses, because of systemic racism, they have a hesitancy to really go to the big banks, if you will, to get their funding. Now you see a lot of them going to fintech and things like that. So we teach them how to access that capital, where to go for that capital. And you hear, I hear a lot from our alumni after they take the course and they're growing and they realize where to go and they were able to access that capital to help them, to help fund their growth.
So I'll turn back to you, Vicki Gray. We're speaking with Daryl Byers, CEO of Interrise, and Vicki Gray, owner of New Chapter HI Services, in this latest business of Boston. You know, the city of Boston commissioned a report that found that just 11% of city contracts went to businesses owned by women or people of color, and only 1.2% went specifically to Black and Hispanic-owned businesses combined, which is disproportionately small given the makeup of businesses. You talked about working for the federal government. Is there any anything in what you're doing with Pathways to Scale that you think will make you more competitive in contracts at the city level, at the state level, at the federal level? And if so, how important is that for you?
Yes, it's super important. And, you know, what they taught me is, you know, you really have to have a strategic plan in every area that you are trying to grow the business in. And, you know, having that strategic plan allows you to really hone in on those different streams of revenue. You know, what I've learned through the program is that you need more than one stream of revenue coming in from different areas. And that's why I serve so many different levels, you know, the federal, state, and residential, you know, because it really helps with our finance. It helps with sales. It helps with growth. It helps with financial cash flow, you know, and these are all the things that I didn't know prior to this program, you know. I had a lot of my business in one specific area, which, you know, could hurt me. You know, learning to diversify. Thank you.
Yeah.
Your portfolio and the sales is super important. And these are the things that I learned from the program, or even understanding, you know, a profit and loss sheet, understanding your financial statements and what areas you need to focus on, you know, understanding your expenses, you know, so just providing us with the actual financial literacy one needs in order to run a successful business is super important.
And briefly, Vicky, what's the dream?
What's the dream? The dream is to actually be a motivational speaker and have about 5 different locations for our services throughout the country, you know, where we can provide individuals with services that entail no dust, no mess, and no headaches.
So, Daryl, I'll turn back to you. You've done a variety of things in your career. You even worked here at WBUR at one point. What do you love best about doing this work?
Well, I'm a former small business owner, so I know the struggles, the loneliness of being a CEO, and the peer-to-peer mentoring that's necessary for businesses to grow. But, you know, what motivates me every day, you know, we have a new program coming out in partnership with the Urban League of Eastern Massachusetts and the Urban League of Springfield. We're going to 8 key cities across the Commonwealth with this program, training them to be contract ready to go and get those large contracts from corporations, higher ed, and the local and state and federal government. So we feel we can reach about 500 businesses over the next year within the Commonwealth through the Streetwise MBA program that we provide. So,
all right. In our Business of Boston, that's Daryl Byers, CEO of the Boston-based company organization InterRise, and Vicky Gray, founder and owner of New Chapter HI Services. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, T.
Great to be here.
It's great to have you. The Business of Boston will be running every other week from now until the end of December. So if you have an idea for a future segment, let us know by texting us. Get started in our texting club by sending the word Boston to 617-766-0382. That's Boston to 617-766-0382. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.